From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack.
Well, you know, it was not necessarily intentional, but we've had a pile of really compelling conversations related to the environment. Makes sense. You got Earth Day coming up and the People's Climate March. So there's a lot of kind of that stuff coming up. And it's timely with the March for Science happening this weekend. But we're going to start this podcast with a clip from our conversation with Aaron Mayer.
Aaron Mayer is the first African-American president of the Sierra Club. He's been blunt about saying that the environmental movement has been largely white, and part of his mission is to connect environmental activism with racial and social justice.
It's his personal story that helps illustrate why environmental issues impact people of color and people in poverty more often. In 1984, Aaron and his young family moved to a poorer part of Albany, and they were downwind from an incinerator that was burning garbage daily. The result was black soot piling up on their cars, driveways, streets. Kids were getting sick, and Aaron decided to go talk to the Sierra Club about it to see what they would say. His experience illustrates how far we've come in the past 30 years or so.
So I walked in this room, and I saw all white people, and I looked in the room. I said, oh, man, I was blown away from their agency. I said, wow, this is the Sierra Club? And it's like, wow, in the New York City. So I was shocked about that, but then I realized it was a statewide meeting, which leaders came from all over the country. So I shrugged it off. I didn't pay any two bits about it. But the thing that really shocked me was the collective turn of heads almost like that when everybody saw me walk in the room. And, it, you know, we talk about creating a welcoming and inviting place. I kind of got the sense that I was not, scared. The folks were like, you know, and so I said, it must be my height, because while I'm on the radio, folks can't see that I'm 6'7". And at that point in time, I was almost like 280 pounds. So I was like a big linebacker walking in. So I figured that's the Mean Joe Green effect, and that was the reason for the collective look and shock. But I was able to give my argument and make the case and talk about the environmental aspects and the and impact and the issue and need to deal with managed solid waste better, that you should not be burning and dumping the waste of the suburbs on poor people and then lie and deceive them, and that they bear all the health consequences and burdens. And we needed them to help us organize and mobilize to beat this thing back. After a lengthy presentation, which I was there with another expert, one of the first questions that was asked of me, and I'll let you guess, what do you think the first question was asked of me?
Don't put me in there.
I just don't want to sound like a monologue. You know, Neely, what do you think the first question was asked of me?
Oh, God, you put me on the spot.
Oh, see, there you go. But, all right, I'm glad you had that black hair. But I'll tell you, it was deeply painful, and it was like a stab in the heart. The first thing I was asked was, well, did you ask the NAACP? And so here I came to an environmental organization talking about environmental issues, talking about the intersection of like class, race, and disempowerment, and how these things are exploited by business interests and laws, and how the whole democratic system collapsed.
And they basically said, well, did you talk to the black
In other people? Words, if black people are having a problem, no matter what it is, you should be going to a black organization.
Don't everybody drop out of the Sierra Club, because there's more to the story.
It's a very powerful but this is how we act. You know,
this was when, by the way, remind our listeners.
This is 1984. This is not
it's still 1984.
Yeah, this is a. About, because we did the argument, I'm sorry, probably about 1987.
Okay.
87. So the long and short of it is that, you know, it was that initial brick wall. And this is just not the Sierra Club. This is with any organizations. When black people want to join the YMCA back, and even right now, if you go into the YMCA, in fact, if you go to a town that has these signs, the coded signs like town residents use a park only, these are still barriers that are designed to keep out the other. And, you know, and so you make these universal things. And so you, when you step across, these things hit you in the face. And it is not that folks were racist. It's just that, you know, they've just figured that if we were having a crisis, you know, I guess, and they're at it. But this is the thing about white privilege and institutional racism. You don't even know that you're being racist and offensive, and how hurtful and unwelcoming and that is. You know, it is that blindness. We have been stuck in this ugly reality of coded speak in America for so long. We've lost sight of what that means and where it came from, but we're still operating on that code.
You could have walked out of that meeting and said, they literally asked me, did you go to the NAACP? I'm not welcome there. That's not...
I could have been human. I could have been emotional. Yeah. I could have reflected the hurt that was in my heart. I could have responded, probably would have had the cops called on me, and then that would be another black story. There's a lot of things that you could do. But I thank them for at least hearing me and understood and accepted their vote of no support, And the fellow who brought me down, it was the longest 3-hour ride back up to Albany Capital Region from New York City. And he spent the whole time, by the way, apologizing profusely. And I said, hey, dude, it's okay. I appreciate the fact that you tried to do something. You tried to get me to a place that you thought would help. And I thanked him, you know. And again, this is the thing that a lot of people of color have to deal with, is that even when you get slapped with oppression, you still have to be apologetic and try to assuage the ego. And so it's kind of interesting. But the long and short of it is that he was so devastated as well by it. I didn't see the fact that he was devastated by that as well. He was as hurt as I. And again, granted, coming from a different dimension, because he learned something about his organization that he had given a lot of his life to. And that broke his... I was transformed by the fact that it also broke his heart as well. So therein lies a little bit of hope.
On the subject of our environment, we had a conversation about how teachers should teach climate change in elementary school, in middle school, and high school.
We welcome Tiara Worthington, an earth sciences teacher at East High School, and Lindsay Cray, founder of Earthworks Institute. And they explained how they respond to students who are challenging the basic science behind climate change.
With my global environment class, and we start laying all this information out to the students, and they're like, oh, this makes lots of sense. I see how it's impacted me. I see it in Rochester. Their next question is, well, why doesn't everybody else see it?
Always.
And that is when you show them the debate. That is when you show them, why do people maybe say, no, this isn't real. And what I've done was I've showed them areas that's kind of like a poor area that makes lots and lots of money out of fracking, that makes lots and lots of money out of using fossil fuels. And those are those delicate situations that you have to be understanding of to understand why people would want to say, well, climate change is probably just something that's, you know, cyclic or not real, you know, because it's really impacting their lives. So to see the pros and cons and have understanding, so then we can go forth and think of ways to alleviate certain situations or help out those people who rely on fossil fuels as a way to feed their family.
Right, talking about job alternatives, for example. You don't have to just rely on that. You can do this as an example. And talking about climate change is another medium to talk about job creation and STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. You know, one of the ways to combat climate change issues is to train our students in science, technology, engineering, and math, and let them be the ones that come up with the great ideas to mitigate the issue.
All right, before I get back to your phone calls, I want to get an email question for Lindsay and Tiara, the educators in the room. Nicole wants to know, how do the educators on the panel deal with parent deniers? Do you encounter that much, Lindsay?
I don't encounter it in this position. I have encountered it before. I worked for an organization out in California, and if you know anything about Central California, it is all ag, all big industrial ag, and that's what their economy runs on. And I was an environmental educator out there, and there were some buzzwords that we were not allowed to use. And sometimes you would come across a buzzword that you didn't know was a buzzword until you said it, and parents would put their hands up and starkly disagree with you. And the way I handle that is just explaining fact. Like, this is science, here's the data, this is where we pull the data from.
Can I ask you a question? I mean, is this like, for example, in some parts of California, they don't want to talk about the fact that almonds need a lot of water.
Right.
Those kinds of things. So in the ag industry, we don't want to talk about certain things needing certain, is that kind of what you
pretty
mean?
Much. So we okay. would, the organization I worked for was a land trust, and so we really focused on conservation of land, much in the same way the Audubon Society does. But our main hotspot to kind of navigate between this whole idea of diplomacy was what the negative environmental effects were of industrial agriculture. So putting too much pesticide, too much fertilizer, things like eutrophication, soil degradation, using too much water, those were real hot spots to talk about in classes, especially where parents were involved. And, you know, if people want to butt heads with you, you know, obviously diplomacy is the first thing, but the second thing is just to say, you know, this is the organization I work for. This is where we get our facts. These are the organizations that we partner with. And we have the information. We have the data. So there's really nothing more that we can say to change the way this conversation is going.
And that's what you do now? If you encountered a parent denier?
If I did, yeah. I'm happy to say that I don't have that issue in Rochester. You know, it's not to say that I wouldn't, and I'm sure that there are people that would disagree with me, but nobody has yet brought it to the forefront, but I'm always happy to have that conversation.
Well, you just wait the phone. There's three phone lines open. We'll see. Tiara, go ahead.
To be honest, I've never encountered that. The only way I'd say I might encounter that is if their students, if their children are saying, I don't believe you. And I never tell a student that they're absolutely wrong. They're completely entitled to their ideas. Again, it's just, I'm going to present you with evidence and facts, and I want you to do the same if you want to have this argument with me.
We'll close with a little fashion. That's kind of unusual for us. We don't discuss fashion trends very much on the show, but this is about more than just style. Robin Givhan is the fashion editor for The Washington Post, and she's the only person to win a Pulitzer Prize for fashion criticism. The Pulitzer Committee said that her work elevates fashion criticism into cultural criticism.
In this clip, you'll hear Evan quoting from a piece Givhan wrote in 2005. She was taking Vice President Dick Cheney to task for what he wore in a ceremony commemorating the liberation of Auschwitz. Givhan explains her thoughts on the problem with what Cheney wore that day, and then Evan asked her about some of her criticism for what former First Lady Michelle Obama wore on vacation.
Like other attendees, the vice president was wearing a hat, but it was not a fedora or a Stetson or a fur hat or any kind of hat that one might wear to a memorial service as a representative of one's country. Instead, it was a knit ski cap embroidered with the words Staff 2001. It was the kind of hat a conventioneer might find in a goodie bag. His wife, Lynn, was seated next to him. Her coat has a hood, too, and it is essentially a parka, but it is black and did not appear to be functioning as either a name tag or a billboard. One wonders if at some point the vice president turned to his wife, took in her attire, and asked himself why they seemed to be dressed for two entirely different events. Some might argue that Cheney was the only attendee with the smarts to dress for the cold and snowy weather, but sometimes, out of respect for the occasion, one must endure a little discomfort. Now, there is little doubt that intellectually, Cheney approached the Auschwitz ceremony with thoughtfulness and respect. But symbolism is powerful. The vice president might have been warm in his parka, ski cap, and hiking boots, but they had the unfortunate effect of suggesting that he was more concerned with his own comfort than the reason for braving the cold at all. End quote.
It was a bit astonishing because it was so, I mean, the photograph was so incredibly striking. You know, a colleague from our photo staff had actually sent it to me because it was so jarring to her. And, you know, the other little piece of that was that that particular ceremony was filled with all kinds of symbolism. I mean, one of the things that was, you know, they included was, you know, the sound of train whistles and searchlights, sort of recalling, you know, the horrors at Auschwitz. And so, you know, it was such a symbolic occasion that it seemed to me that the clothing was even more important because, you know, it really was trying to tell a story through impressions, through sights and sounds.
In 2009, you took the First Lady to task for wearing shorts when coming off of Air Force One for his vacation. And so let me read what you wrote then, and then I can't wait to hear the kind of response you got. You wrote this, quote, "Ultimately, the First Lady can't be, nor should she be, just like everyone else. Hers is a life of responsibilities and privileges. She gets the fancy jet. She has to dress for the ride, or at least that's as it should be. The reality is that a good portion of the culture has become loudly vocal about how clothes don't matter and how it's snobbish or shallow to suggest that they do. But clothes are part of our broader aesthetic obligation to each other. That commitment pushes homeowners to mow their lawns and not be a blight to their neighborhood. And in the White House, the aesthetic demands are higher than they are on Main Street. Avoiding the appearance of queenly behavior is politically wise, but it does American culture no favors if a First Lady tries so hard to be average that she winds up looking common." End quote. Now, I'm sure you heard some feedback from readers saying, way too far, let her wear shorts. You know, who are we to tell her she can't wear shorts? What kind of feedback did you get on that?
Oh, just a smidge. You're absolutely right. I mean, there were people who were definitely outraged, and there is always that contingent that really makes the argument that the clothes should not matter at all. And, you know, my response to them is that clothes, of course, matter because it's why, you know, we wear black to a funeral. It's why, you know, there's this whole conversation about trying not to upstage a bride at a wedding. It's why there are interview suits and all these pieces of clothing that are for very particular occasions. And in that case, yes, she was on vacation. But the reality is that when you're the First Lady, you're never on vacation. And I mean, I do think that the First Lady has a somewhat more challenging role than the President in the sense that the President is public all the time. The First Lady sort of operates in this gray area during which there are occasions when she is private and there are occasions when she's clearly public, and then there's this sort of middle ground. And this was, I think, in her mind, a private occasion, but she was stepping off of Air Force One, and there were military men and women at the foot of that aircraft, and there was a press pool assembled to take her photograph. So this was clearly a public moment. And at that point, she is not representing herself on vacation. She is occupying the role of First Lady, and she is representing us all.
And that's Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
You can also hear us on the WXXI mobile app. And I think that ending was much smoother than last week. So we're on a continual.
It's the best I've ever done. I think it's literally the best I've ever done.
Yep.
Okay. Well, it'll be much rougher next week. Way too much polish. Have a nice weekend, and we're right back with you on Monday.